From the studios of WBAA Public Radio in West Lafayette, this is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. We appreciate you tuning into the program this month, and if ever you have a question you'd like to make sure gets on this program, email that to news@wbaa.org or tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, let's start with the recent graduation, and you said that you felt like you were sort of giving a speech to your classmates in a way or two.
It was the first class that arrived after I was officially on duty. I informally helped welcome the class before it, but I wasn't on the payroll here yet back in the 12. So this was I've sort of thought of this group as the cohort or the class that I arrived with, and I did tell them I hope they didn't mind if I think of them that way.
And during that speech, you did a lot of talking about how they should have humility as they graduate from Purdue. And you mentioned, interestingly, I wanted to have you expound on this. You said that you had learned a lesson in your own private life that you called, and I'm quoting now, "one especially low moment when I felt I had let down a cause and, in fact, a president of the United States." Can you tell us what that low moment was?
I was working in the Reagan White House, and I'd have to scratch around and remember the exact nature of it, but of the content of it. But there was some controversy we were dealing with, and I was quoted in a way on the page one, I think it was, of the Washington Post, in a story that didn't reflect well on our point of view, and the administration's point of view. It was that sort of thing. I was the subject of some unhelpful publicity, and so I was feeling down on myself at the time, and that's when Mac Baldridge, terrific guy, used to ride. In fact, he died on a rodeo horse. He was a not that many years after, but Mac Baldridge, after whom the Baldridge Quality Award, the most sought after such a recognition a business can achieve, was named. Now he could, without my saying anything, he could tell I was really dejected, and we were standing in the cabinet room before a cabinet meeting, and he punched me on the arm and said what I told the students. He said, basically, you know, come on, Mitch, good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment. And this is a guy who had led Fortune 100 companies and had a wonderful career, and when he told me that, it stuck with me.
Also, in that speech, you talked a fair amount about the disparities that have kind of been laid bare by the election and other things between, the divides between, in some cases, the educated and the less educated in this country, but the socioeconomic issues. Interestingly, you admonished the entrepreneurs in the group in front of you. You said, you know, many of you may go on to found companies, and you encouraged them to find ways to help their classmates, regardless of their socioeconomic status. But your message was not help more people get college degrees, which I thought was interesting, even though, you know, that's a major contributor to doing well in America today by a lot of standards. You said, don't tell other people how to live their lives. It's not your place. Could not some of those people use the higher education that a Purdue provides?
Maybe. I was making, I think, a larger point. In each, I believe, of the last 3 years, because I'm preoccupied with this, in different words, I have urged our graduates to, first of all, to recognize that by becoming a graduate of Purdue University, they have entered the new, I always say, aristocracy, and not based on family name or title or property or because, you know, daddy was a commissar in the Communist Party. None of those sorts of elites, but the cognitive elite that in a knowledge society, if people aren't careful, they will drift into a cocoon of people just like them. And I've urged each of the last, I think, maybe three classes in one way or another, try not to let that happen. And I said to this group, it will, if you do, if you allow yourself to become isolated professionally, socially, residentially, from large numbers of your fellow citizens who weren't fortunate enough to get a degree from a place like this, It will disserve them, and it will limit you. You will be a narrower person than if you know a wide range of and interact with a wide range of people. So that was more or less the message. And I did suggest to them that I said there are too many people think of their fellow citizens who aren't as perhaps as well educated, or they think they're not. Not as creatures of dignity, but as objects of therapy. And I just challenge the notion that somehow because you're better educated or were blessed with better cognitive ability, that it's your right to go around telling other people what decisions they should make.
I want to talk more about one big thing you're doing to try to get more people a college education in just a minute, but let me first get to a question that's come in from a listener. In the intervening months since we last talked, Kirsten tweeted at us, and she says, does President Daniels think it's fair to ask faculty and staff to give back parts of their salaries on Day of Giving and then award 2.5% merit pay increases?
Well, nobody asked anybody to give back part of their salaries. Our development people, as they have built the Day of Giving, have invited faculty and staff, just like other of our stakeholders, alums, and so forth. And it's been growing. It's been fast growing, but it's purely voluntary. Nobody has to do a thing. Something like maybe 20% of the gifts. We had a record number of gifts, many of them quite small, but something like 20% of them this year came from faculty and staff who on their own seem to feel that's something they feel good about doing. By the way, 2.5% is at least competitive, probably going to be more than much of the rest of higher ed once again this year. Each year for the last several, we have either matched or exceeded the higher ed median. So 2.5% is a more than respectable number all by itself.
A reminder that, like Kirsten, you can tweet questions to us at WBAA News on Twitter. You can also email them to news@wbaa.org, and we'll get them on our next show. So let's get to arguably the biggest news of the last month, Purdue's deal to buy Kaplan University. There are a lot of questions. I will try not to dominate the show with them, but we could do a whole show on this for sure. So let me start with this one. You have, in this job and your previous one, made some big choices and you have talked about the value of going big in a lot of different ways. Some of those choices have worked out well, some of them not as well as you would have liked. Some have been unpopular. But seldom, I have to say, have I seen so many rank-and-file people who seem to have questions about a decision you've made as this one. And this was particularly evident in that last Faculty Senate meeting. There were lots and lots of questions to you. Were you fully prepared for the kind of backlash to it?
Sure. Most of the questions, I would say, were good ones. They're good answers. We'd ask all the same questions. We added the advantage, those of us who'd worked on this, of a 5.5-month head start. So a lot of the questions were factually unfounded, and others we supplied answers for. People will have a different viewpoint. 42 people, a bare quorum was around. They even have a vote, and 42 people on a faculty of close to 3,000 cast those votes. So they're entitled to their opinion, but we have far more people than that from the faculty who have stepped forward and said, I'm interested in this. I'd like to participate in this. I have a course that maybe I'd like to teach online one day. And so we'll continue to answer questions as they come and welcome in to this project what I believe is going to be a very large number of people who see the good purpose of the mission to bring education to people who aren't able to come to this campus or a regional campus, and to position Purdue for a future in which online capabilities are going to be more important than they already are, and a future for which before this action we were not very well prepared. I told a TV interviewer just the other day, I don't want my successors 10 or 15 years from now to look around and say, what were those people thinking? How did they miss this? How did they leave us unprepared for a world in which a digital education is playing a larger role.
With respect to the comments that have come in from faculty and staff and alumni and things like that, which you have said in on multiple occasions you think have been positive, is there a way to make those more public so that they can be seen? Because I've heard a lot of anecdotal evidence, but I haven't actually seen names attached to comments and things like that.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, Stan, I don't have to tell you what makes print a handful of people saying something negative will always get a lot more attention. And we've seen lots of examples of that even in the previous school year.
Although we have to say that, I mean, the Faculty Senate, which is designed to represent the faculty and the university at large, was, you know, majority questioning at least or perhaps even against the decision.
They have a right to express their opinion and certainly to ask the questions, and we'll keep answering them. There's a good answer for every question that's been asked, I think. And again, we ask all these questions for 5.5 months as we looked at all this. But, you know, there have been some very highly positive articles in the national press, national education press.
We should say there have been a fair amount that there's not been a lot of middle ground on this. People have been very for it or very against it.
Well, any new ideas like that, and there are people who have their own self-interest reasons, I guess, for throwing rocks at it. But the Board of Trustees, those of us who've worked on it, are very excited about the possibilities for a new dimension of service here at Purdue and for being well-equipped for a future that's going to be different, whether people have faced up to that or not.
Let me ask you, as a journalist, I'm interested about the transparency part of it because I like data like you do and I like being able to get at public records. And so there's a piece of state law that says that these public benefit corporations can be set up and they aren't quite subject to the same rules that Purdue right now is as a part of state government. And so I wanted to ask you about that. Why not say, look, we know this law exists. We know it was just put in. But why not, as part of the deal with Kaplan, say, we would like to be more open and transparent and subject it to a similar level of scrutiny that Purdue already is because we believe in transparency?
Well, I think the new entity will be very transparent about most things it does. What you really want to know is this public records law and so forth, very burdensome. The whole premise of that law is that there are taxpayer dollars involved. If the taxpayers are paying for something, then somebody should have a right to know everyone's schedule and read all their emails and all that business. And there's not a taxpayer dollar involved in this.
Well,
WGU Indiana is I always described it as a public institution in the sense it's open university and it's serving the public in Indiana, but it's not subject to that law. No one ever suggested it should be.
Well, you just said you've heard from professors who say they might want to teach classes in this new rubric. Those professors who are now Purdue employees, I don't know if their employment would change, but taxpayer dollars certainly help fund those professors in a lot of cases.
Well, you're asking about a future where we haven't arrived at yet. But if we begin to offer Purdue courses over the Kaplan platform, and I hope one day we will, then yes, all that would be as open as it is today if it's coming off of this campus.
So I've heard a couple of people, you know, point out that, look, it's not a done deal yet. There are various regulatory agencies, as you said in the announcement, that have to sign off on this. And some people have gone as far as telling me, look, this thing isn't over till it's over. Based on the fact that there has been some public negative reaction to it, are you more concerned today than you were when you announced it that any one of these agencies that has to sign off on the deal might think twice about it?
No, but I don't really know what to expect. It's the first time they've dealt with this, so there's no with this exact kind of transaction. Look, Kaplan, which has a better performance record in terms of graduation and so forth than our regional campuses or Ivy Tech. Kaplan, which has a graduate or alumni satisfaction records or ratings equal to Purdue University, was accredited last year for 10 years by the same accreditor that will be here on this campus looking at us next year. So they went through everything and gave them a clean bill of health in another 10 years. So one would rather suspect that they won't have a problem simply reaffirming a judgment that they just made. But I don't know. We'll see. You know, I just would encourage people who are asking these questions, keep asking, but have an open mind, because you could be stamping yourself as a real troglodyte by standing in the way of something that can help us realize Purdue's mission. I hope we don't have too many people on this campus who say, the heck with those folks, with those single moms, those working adults, that massive number of people who started college and didn't finish. We don't care about them. I don't think there are too many people on this campus who say that. I don't think there are too many people on this campus who still think, well, this digital education is a passing fad. We'll go back to the sage on the stage, you know, two lectures and a seminar method pretty soon. I don't think we have too many of those. And unless you hold one of those two notions, then you ought to come and help us and work with us in trying to move Purdue into a future of broader service and more modern capabilities.
So allow me a little bit of setup on this last question about this, and then I promise I'll move on to other things. So you were talking about people allowing themselves, you know, to have an open mind about this, and I've been trying to process the various ways you can think about this. And so I noticed that you codenamed this Project Morrill after the Vermont lawmaker whose name is on the Land Grant Act, which helped create Purdue and a lot of other schools. And lots of people have questioned the assertion of whether this fits Purdue's land grant mission. And some of them have said that to me, and I said, well, wait a minute. You know, you've said it's about reaching students that Purdue doesn't reach. I buy that argument, and I've made the argument back to them. Justin Morrill could never have understood what internet education was going to be. And they, encouraging me to keep an open mind, came back with this, which I wanted to present to you. They said, you know, even in the mid-1800s, when this bill was written, there were things like correspondence courses, some of them good, some of them of questionable quality. And aren't the correspondence courses of the mid-1800s similar to some of the online education from the universities of Phoenix and Southern New Hampshire and all those others that exist today? And so here's my question to you, which is slightly different. Is not the land grant mission in some way tied to the land, to being in the atmosphere of a college campus around other people who want to learn, around learned people who have already been through the study and want to be a part of a college atmosphere? And thus, you know, the physical land in which billions of dollars has already been invested in the land, the people, et cetera, doesn't that have big value in knowing that the university system Purdue has spent all this 150 years putting together? We know that works. I mean, isn't there a value in the atmosphere of being on the campus?
Yes, there's a value, but it's not going to be available to an enormous number of people. And in this day and age, unlike the 1800s, you need something beyond high school, preferably a college education, to have a really productive and fulfilling life. It's a very new and different age. And there's no way that all the people who need that are going to be able in life to come to a residential setting. You know, I showed the Faculty Senate a series of quotes at the end of the presentation. People saying these rather disparaging, sneering things. It's inferior education. They're stealing from the U.S. Treasury. And then I disclosed to them those quotes came from 1870. This is what was said by the elite academics of the day about the land-grant schools like Purdue. And I don't doubt that 60 years ago when Purdue opened regional campuses, people said exactly the same thing and looked down their nose at the whole idea. But the democratization of higher education is no longer just a good thing to do, to spread this as widely as possible. It's a necessary thing to do. And so we're just trying to take part in it. And as I say, while doing so, position Purdue for a future that I don't pretend to know exactly what it will look like, but I know that digital education will be a bigger part than it is now.
This is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. You can tweet questions to us at WBAA News on Twitter, and you can send them via email to news@wbaa.org. So on to other things. I came across this graph, which I've put in front of you. Inside Higher Ed did the graph, and I wanted you to help me interpret it because I'm not entirely sure what to make of it. It shows that the amount that colleges and universities are discounting their tuition, in other words, using scholarships and grants and other means to keep students from paying what it it actually costs per student to teach them has risen considerably in the last 10 years, and it's close to the point where universities only reap from their students about half the money they need to sustain all of the educational facilities and professorships and such necessary to teach. I wondered what your reaction to these numbers were.
I've known about them. It's pretty well understood. It's mainly, but not entirely, a private school phenomenon. And we've talked on this show before. Higher ed has been getting by with these raising the sticker price, and because people had no other way of knowing how to measure quality. People have not been measuring the academic or intellectual growth of students on campuses, for instance. In the absence of any other proof, they've associated a higher sticker price with quality. If it costs more, it must be better. Meanwhile, in order to attract students that they want, and in some cases to attract higher caliber students, there's been a lot of discounting going on, backdoor discounting, I usually call it. We don't do it here at Purdue. We have a very low percentage. 10 or 15% of our aid is merit-based at all. We don't engage in negotiating and haggling, which I think the article referenced. It's quite common now.
You don't want to be in a bidding war with IU over a student for something like that.
I'm not going to single out any particular institution, but I learned from our enrollment people some time ago. There are a lot of them who buy their profile, meaning in order to get higher quality students, they have to go out and give maybe wealthy students money. Now, we are concentrating our resources, the money we do have for scholarships, and we're raising record amounts of it right now because our alums are very pleased, they tell us, with our holding tuition down and holding the costs down. And they have we've been breaking records for scholarship dollars donated. We concentrate them on the basis of need. We don't give it to wealthy kids just to make them feel better or to woo them away from some other school. And I'm happy to tell you that, as you know, the academic profile each year here at Purdue has gone up, even though we are not involved in those in that bidding war that too many other schools are.
And I wonder if you feel the same thing that I remember from my own college search, which came down to a large public institution versus a small private institution. And to me, it was an atmospheric thing. They just felt vastly different. Are you trying to keep that number down by focusing on the fact that, you know, you've got different things at a large Research One institution than a smaller school would have?
Sure. We have features that I certainly tout to students all the time, the advantages of scale and size. I also think Purdue does a really good job of making possible life at a human scale, even inside a 31,000 undergraduate population. The incredible number of clubs and organizations that we have, almost 1,000 of them, the learning communities where so many of our students live, at least the first year or two, 30, 40 students probably studying a similar curriculum, living together and learning from each other. The Honors College be another example. So I think we are trying to provide an atmosphere that has the best of both, personal attention, and but also the advantages of size and scale. You know, it's I hear all the time, and I guess we probably all know young people like this. They and sometimes their parents are flattered when a college says, "Well, we'll give you a scholarship," even if they wind up paying more net. I don't know what to say to folks like that. I guess it's a human trait, but it's a game we decide we choose not to play here at Purdue. A
couple other things in our last few minutes. You were given an award last week from the Japanese government, the Order of the Rising Sun, and I've known you long enough to see you receive quite a number of awards and merits and things like that one. Where does this one rank?
Pretty high. Honestly, it came out of the blue. You get a call from somebody who says, from the consul, and he says that the emperor has chosen you. In fact, I had the invitation to go to Tokyo and receive the award from Prime Minister Abe in the presence of the emperor, followed by a short audience with the emperor. A once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, of course. Couldn't go just because of the press of commencement week and other business. It just wouldn't have worked. But we had a wonderful little ceremony hosted by the ambassador and his wife at his residence, and a lunch to follow. My first boss, former Senator Lugar, came, and former chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, and said a few words and offered the toast. So, yeah, we worked very, very hard to rebuild and then to build further relationships between Indiana and Japan. And it led to thousands and thousands of new jobs, something like $3 billion in new investment during the time that I served in public office. Right here, of course, the Toyota put its second plant in the state here at West Lafayette until Subaru needed the entire place again. But that'd be one example. So it was in part because it was so surprising and unexpected, and in part because when I took a look at it, I found out that it's not that often given. It did mean a lot, and you know, anytime I drive by one of those facilities, and there are almost 300 Japanese investments here in the state, I'm reminded of how good it's been for our economy here, and also for, I believe, relations between our country and theirs.
One more quick education policy matter in our last couple of minutes. There's been a lot of talk in the last week or two about what the Trump administration plans to do with the public service loan forgiveness program. And for those who don't know, it's a deal where if someone gives about 10 years of their career to a public service job, whatever's left on their student loans is forgiven by the federal government. And I thought of you because you've talked a lot about how taking this job and the previous one were good for public service. And of course, we've talked a lot about how student debt can be reduced. I wondered what you think of this program, especially since working for Purdue ostensibly would qualify.
I don't think too much of this program, and I'm not alone. The Brookings Institution, which basically is a left-of-center organization, has panned it and called for it to go away. It's got all kinds of mechanical problems, first of all. Its costs have exploded, as government programs tend to do, way beyond the original estimates. The defaults the cost of the subsidies and then is way up. And the GAO also has criticized it strongly. So I think there are reasons it just isn't working very well. And I'll say one more thing about it. I have always been skeptical of the whole concept, to be honest. If we're going to start forgiving loans, I would start with people who are going to go out in the productive sector of society and create wealth that leads to taxes that can provide the next student loan, as opposed to subsidizing those who will go to the tax-consuming part of society. Those jobs are important, but I wouldn't favor them in the way this thing does over those that that pay the bills. And but, you know, whether you like the concept or don't, the thing is not working well at all, and it's costing a bundle, and I wouldn't be surprised if somebody tried to reform it.
All right. Well, President Daniels, thanks as always for your time. We'll do it again next month.
Look forward to it.
This has been Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Major support for the monthly conversation with Mitch Daniels comes from Gaylor Electric. Gaylor provides electrical services from pre-construction design through project completion and a 24/7 service department. Information at gaylor.com.